ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm Peter Martin, host of The Economy Stupid, where we find economics in relationships.
She only wants a man if he's really, really good.
In the Reserve Bank board.
I knew. Everybody on the board knew recession was coming.
And in food.
It's about the cup of diesels required through the life cycle to get that chicken patty on your burger.
The Economy Stupid. Search for The Economy Stupid on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ask any researcher about the challenges they face, and you'll always hear there's simply not enough money to go around.
Yes, it's nearly budget time, and scientists are keen to find out the actual research funding bottom line.
Meanwhile, they're applying for grants which have a 1 in 10 chance of being funded, at best. So on the Science Show this week, we ask, who will stand up for Australia's researchers?
Because we have a choice between an Academy of Science and an Academy of Silence. I'm Robin Williams.
And I'm Belinda Smith. Also on the program, a tribute to the man who gave us the naked ape.
And we find out how to get young people to fall in love with science and stay in love with it. But first, we head to Northern Australia to visit the lab of Professor Michael Burt, who started off as a geologist and is now a geochemist at James Cook University, Cairns.
Professor, could you introduce me to your isotope?
Certainly. They're everywhere. I mean, you're a big bag of elements, you know that, your water and your carbon and your nitrogen. But you're also a big bag of isotopes, and so am I. And isotopes exist for most elements, and all they are is that element, so the number of protons, with a different number of neutrons. So let's take hydrogen, poor old little proton, no neutrons. There are three isotopes. So deuterium has another neutron, tritium has two neutrons. And so because of that, they behave differently in natural cycles. When you breathe in, when you breathe out, you're changing your oxygen, your hydrogen isotope composition.
Now, you remind me somewhat of Sherlock Holmes, who's looking at everything, including the dirt or sniffing the air, and from that getting clues on bigger stories. Is that roughly it?
I think that's true. I mean, you don't hear about isotopes a lot, but they're behind most things. So when you hear about a temperature record from an ice core in Antarctica, it's isotopes, it's not temperature. When you think about sea level in the past and how we know that, it's isotopes, it's not sea level, they're just reconstructed as that. I tend to work more in environmental records, so using isotopes to look at vegetation and fire in the past. We also can use it to look at what you eat when you're dead.
Let's start with fire. If you were to go to a landscape and take some samples, presumably you're doing it in the soil and places like that, can you tell something about the fire history of that region?
Not from the soil, but from a lake that's right next to it. So lakes are little tape recorders, so they accumulate sediment from the bottom up. You go and you take your lake core, and within that core there's charcoal that came from those fires, and a lot of people count the charcoal to see how much fire was there. If you add the isotopes for the charcoal, and you can tell what was burning, was it a grassland or was it a forest? And that in turn relates back to climate. And what we've shown in the Northern Territory is that you can use the isotopes and other measures to show that indigenous fire regimes were established there at least 11,000 years ago and possibly 40,000 years ago.
Do you mean it started possibly 40,000 years ago and continued until 11,000 years ago, or what?
Potentially started 40,000 years ago. We don't have all the markers back that far. From 11,000 years ago, we can definitively say that the sort of cool burning that Aboriginal people did up here in this part of the world was established and was maintained through till European invasion.
You see a difference 11,000 years ago in the samples?
Yes. Basically, the isotope composition changes, so you see more grass burning, and we know from the pollen what the total vegetation was. And so we can say it was the grass burning, it wasn't hot fires, which is what you tend to get without humans or with European humans. So that change, which is unique in 150,000 years, can be reliably attributed to Indigenous fire management.
So that was a sophisticated way of treating the landscape, even those many thousands of years back.
Yes, it was managing the land for biodiversity, for safety, really, for promoting food resources, animal and plant. So it was used in a very sophisticated fashion earlier in the year. And yeah, people were doing it from 11,000 years ago, probably from 40,000 years ago.
Why before did you mention the icebergs and the water flow?
So periodically in the last 130,000 years ago, maybe 10 times, there were rapid melting events of the northern ice sheets, and those icebergs flowed out into the North Atlantic and melted, and so the seawater became fresher. And the Gulf Stream, which is a warm current that flows up the east coast, couldn't dive down and return to the deep ocean circulation. The east coast of the US, sorry. And ordinarily, it dives down and rejoins the major ocean circulation pattern, but it stops. So you get a buildup of heat in the northern hemisphere, and that causes droughts in China. And with that same record from the fire record, we can also show that Heinrich events caused it to be incredibly wet up here for periods of, well, relatively short, geologically speaking, let's say 1,000 years.
Did you say Heinrich events?
Heinrich events, named after Professor Dr. Heinrich, not Heimlich. He was the one that found these little pebbles in deep ocean sediments that could have only got there by being carried there by icebergs, and that's how they defined the Heinrich events. And it turns out to be a quite important driver of climate, and potentially we're messing with that now. And if the Gulf Stream shuts down again and it's slowing, then we can expect it to get very wet in northern Australia.
So it makes sense you're doing work on that from here, northern Australia, as you said. This is a good vantage point from which to do it.
Yeah, it's been worked on in the northern hemisphere. The good thing about being in Australia is there's not that many of us, so we've still got to do a lot of stuff. And there was a big gap in terms of how Heinrich events might influence the southern hemisphere and Australia in particular, or the Australian region. And it took a long time to sort out. It wasn't like we were looking for Heinrich events. We got a record and then we had to figure out what it meant, and it just so happened that's the way it lined up very nicely.
So what do you do in the field work? Would you have all your samples sent to you so you just sit comfortably in this laboratory? Or do you range by a lake, as you said, next to a forest, working out what the sludge might be made of?
Well, I'm a geologist, so I got into geology so I can go out and get down and dirty. So we spent 10, 15 years tooling around northern Australia looking for good lakes, all the way from Cape York through to Wolf Creek Crater in Western Australia, which is, of course, dry, and all stops in between, trying to develop these records of changes in vegetation, climate, and fire. And that's what I'm in the job for.
I say, did you know when you were beginning your work, say, as a student, and then I'm doing chemistry, therefore I'm sitting in a lab squirting all sorts of liquids, or I'm a geologist, I'm going to work for a mining company. All those predictable things lapse when you look around as to what you could possibly be doing, ranging from icebergs to forests like you.
Well, I always thought I was going to be an exploration geologist, and my first job was actually in Borneo looking for gold. They ended up throwing somebody out of a helicopter a few years after I was there. No, they didn't expect it, but it was certainly terminal. That was years after I was there. But it's actually kind of boring if you're at the bottom. You're just putting dirt in bags day in, day out. So I came back and did a PhD and ended up where I am today. But it's been a random walk of opportunities, all of which I tried to ensure allow me to do good work and go to interesting places and not have to kill people.
Not have to kill people. That's very interesting. Yes, but do you accept that association with being a detective, trying to work out a big story from tiny clues?
It's very much detective work. I mean, I said you're a bag of isotopes, and a lot of the work with isotopes is related to your isotopic composition. So I could tell from your hair, not that you have that much left, but if you went to Finland and came back and you didn't cut your hair in the interim, I could take your hair and I could tell you you'd been to Finland. And if you ate a lot of fish there, I could tell that. And after you're dead, I could do the same things with your fingernails, your bones, with your teeth. And This is actually used forensically in the modern day, but it's also used widely in archaeology. And that's one of the things that we're getting into.
And finally, a story we did a couple of weeks ago about a chemist, actually an astronomical chemist, who was brought in LA to work out why there was so much lead around after the fires. You wouldn't have been surprised, would you?
No, because the way you would track that lead is, you guessed it, it would be the lead isotope composition, and they would be relating that, I believe it was related to houses, so it would be lead pipes or lead flashing or whatever that would have come from somewhere different, and it would be distinct from the lead isotope composition in the soil or in the water, and you'd be able to tell that.
Professor Michael Bird from James Cook University, how do you feel about being described as a big bag of elements, Belle?
Robin, I'm okay with it as long as the main element is oxygen and not something like mercury. What would your primary element be, Robin?
Well, for reasons you know, nowadays it's kryptonite. The Australian Academy of Science is led by its president, Professor Jagadish, who often on this program has said in terms of support, our science is broken, and to fix it, we need a science champion. One leader who could fulfil that role, in a way, she's been doing it for 10 years, is Academy CEO Anna Maria Arabia, whose calm, brilliant authority has held the shards together so well that many have not been aware of the crisis. And yet there is a deeper question. How come Australia's scientific research really is so marvellous by any standards? Anna Maria Arabia.
Science is the only universal language we have left. It is the language that goes across borders, goes across religion, goes across conflict, goes across a range of things that divide us and can be polarising. And if we ever lose sight of that, and if we allow science to not remain the universal language, there is a risk that there is very little that unites us. When I then reflect that back to science in Australia, you're right, it could have been very different. I mean, in many ways, our scientific endeavour in this country is very young. It really only prospered after World War II. So much of Australian scientific history started in the UK and in other countries where Australians had to travel to undertake their work. And, you know, a great case in point is Sir Mark Oliphant, the first president of the Australian Academy of Science, who did all of his work in the UK. Radar technology enabled those jet planes to see the Germans and take down their planes before they were struck themselves. And that technology went on to change this world quite significantly. And Sir Mark Oliphant came to Australia and he remained here. And I think all of the fellows who are fellows of this academy, my own journey in science, looks at those individuals and what they built. And it is something very special. So science in Australia is on every measure of the highest quality. It competes with international scientific endeavour. I sometimes think we've got more fire in our belly and a fair bit of determination because we have to reach out to the rest of the world to collaborate. And doing that is that little bit harder sometimes. The story of science in Australia is about international research collaboration, and we must hold on to that and not put up walls around it. It's what makes us strong. It's what keeps us open. It's what enables us to benefit from knowledge around the world. And Australia needs that.
Indeed. Mark Oliphant, you mentioned, one of the very first people to head the Academy. And he wasn't in the Oppenheimer film, whereas he was the person who actually took the letter to America and made it happen. And you mentioned the radar. Well, this is miniature radar that would then fit in aircraft. And if you're thinking, well, that's very distant, go into the kitchen and there's a microwave. Right. Bingo! Mark Oliphant, a dear friend who actually was a champion for peace. Now, let me tell you a bit of a story about ways in which perhaps the Academy has been ambitious. And that is, Professor Jagadish has said, given the lack of support in some quarters for science, we need a champion of science. And that would be, I would have thought, possibly a role that you could play even more so on the way out. But what really would this champion of science do to to make a difference?
I think we need an army of champions of science, leading voices who are showing and illustrating the value of science in our society, the need for science to guide our future, to guide our decisions. I mean, really, Robin, science is everywhere, and it is actually spoken about in many ways, possibly without using the word science. So when I look at people who put solar panels on their roofs, they're benefiting from science.
Research done here, but sold in China, you know, huge industry.
Indeed. When I look at technological advancement and when I see parliamentarians, ministers and others talk about energy transitions, talk about national security, talk about technology transfer, talk about most things on their agenda, beneath that, within that, driving that is actually science. And I think we can do better to translate those stories so that they appear in that public discourse. Well, you hear politicians and members of the public talk about the cost of living. It's as though that's separate to science. It's in no way separate to science. Agricultural science means that our agricultural yields are greater. If there's more food being grown, it's cheaper. It's cheaper at the supermarket. There is a direct link. Mm. And that is in everything we do. It is so ubiquitous, sometimes it's not seen. So I think we do need to get better at telling those stories and championing science at every opportunity, to telling the good stories of science, but not shying away from, you know, perhaps alerting around the possible missed opportunities if we do take our eye off the ball.
Well, let me just tell you a brief story from way back. Many of my stories are from way back, but this one is actually related to Canberra, because we had a quantum program that came before Catalyst, and we were going to celebrate aspects of science with the Prime Minister, a fellow called Hawke. Mm-hmm. And he had agreed to come along. But you see, one of the problems was that the lack of support for science, Barry Jones, the minister, called the scientists themselves. He said everyone should be part of the championing. They hadn't been, and he called them wimps.
He did? Outside Questacon.
Outside Questacon, that's right. So the Prime Minister was delayed and came to the live broadcast rather, well, he wasn't cross, he was rather mystified as to what had happened just now. Wimps happens to be a term that applies to physics as well, and the possible nature of dark matter. But the thing is, how do you galvanise people, as Barry Jones was trying to get, from people in science or community outside science to act together to make a difference?
That was a really catalytic moment. So Barry Jones did call those scientists wimps. He was seeking to improve investment for science in the cabinet and felt that he didn't have the support of the sector, that they weren't able to organise themselves in a way to give strength to his arm. And they had actually been protesting around cuts to science and creating some chaos, which is never a bad thing, really. And from that moment, very catalytic moment, was born the Federation of Australian Scientific and Technological Societies, FASTS. FASTS today, to your audience, that is Science and Technology Australia. I was once the CEO there, and I started as the CEO of FASTS, and we did a fairly significant rebranding exercise to call it Science and Technology Australia. And that was around rebirthing it in some ways so that it's very broad membership of scientists who work across disciplines and who are at the coalface of scientific research and endeavour could have a voice, could organise, and so that STA could be the peak body for science and technology in Australia. And indeed, it holds that position today. How do we make sure that they continue to have a voice? Unity is important. Strategy is important. Having a collective voice and knowing what we're asking for. I think a real risk to our sector is fragmentation. We should avoid that at all costs. So organisations that enable us to come together are important. And not just come together as scientists. I think we would do well to create allies in other non-scientific areas. Of course, scientists would say that we need to improve their conditions, their funding, their resources. It's much better when other sectors say we need science so that our world, our workforce, our industries can thrive and they recognise the value science brings to all of us.
Congratulations and good luck with the future.
It's been an extraordinary journey. Thank you for being part of it too, Robin.
Anna Maria Arabia, who stepped down just a few days ago as the CEO
of the Australian Academy of Science. Watch for her name soon in, who knows, yet another position of leadership in this uncertain nation.
It's interesting to hear Anna Maria talk about getting the science that underpins everything around us into everyday discussions, because something else that isn't widely known is just how hard it can be to get the funding to actually do that science. Someone who knows all about this is Dr. Shane Huntington. He's CEO of the Australian Society for Medical Research and hosts a program on Triple R in Melbourne. He interviews lots of PhD students. And I asked him, what is the state of research funding in Australia today?
This is an interesting question, because I think what you have to do is put it in the context of what it used to be like as well. So back in my day, if I can use that phrase, I remember having to compete with usually about three other researchers to get my funding. So the success rate was about 25%. Today, that number would be 10 or 11 researchers. So you would have to beat 10 or 11 other excellent people to get your funding. So even just that metric alone in the space of 20 years has changed in a really phenomenal way. We also see the amount of investment we have as a proportion of GDP has just dropped like a stone. So it seemed to be peaking out at about 2008. I think it was over about 2.2%. It's now, I think it's under 1.7%. And that's a huge change. It also means that we are lagging behind all the other OECD countries in quite a major way. We're going down. We're not going up. We're going down exactly at the time when we should be heading in the other direction.
When you hear politicians say things like, oh, Australia's punching above their weight when it comes to research, what do you feel?
Well, I think Australia has an incredible system of producing great researchers, but sometimes that comes from adversity. It doesn't always come from us having a nice, cushy environment to work in. We have great people. We have inventive people. We've seen that over the years, but you don't get a free ticket if you're in government because great people are doing the work. You still have to support them. And that's where we're starting to really fail. I think we've done well over the years because our people are so good. And they've done a lot with very little. But there's a crunch point where that's no longer going to work. And we are well beyond that crunch point now. And it's going to have very lasting detrimental outcomes for the country as a whole.
Post-crunch point, what effects have you seen in research in Australia?
So what I see at the moment is a research community that is so out of hope, I think. I was speaking to a researcher this morning, someone I was assisting with a grant, and we were talking about the success rates of those particular grants being, you know, around 10%. This person is spending an extraordinary amount of time writing that grant, but knows that she has almost no chance of getting it. I don't really understand why we're treating some of our best people that way. And it's not a small number, it's the majority of them. And you might think, oh, but you know, there's going to be some that obviously we shouldn't fund. I agree. I don't think we should fund more than about 40% of research applications. People might think I'm harsh in saying that, but I think that keeps things competitive. But 40% is a bit different to 10%. 10% changes the culture. It means senior people are spending more time writing grants, less time training junior people. Junior people are doing work, extraordinary hours that they shouldn't have to do early in their careers just to keep up. It's become Lord of the Flies, basically. And it's because we've triaged the system down to such an awful level that it's starting to collapse. We won't see the real effects of that for a little while. Research is a long-term game. And the way I always put this is for every decade of damage we do, it'll take at least two decades to repair. So we at the moment are carving off whole sections of our research activity. You look at the cuts to CSIRO and other organizations, the medical research community itself is being heavily impacted. And what's that going to look like in 20 or 30 years? Because right now, our society is benefiting from stuff we started 20, 30 or even more years ago.
Like what?
So good examples are immunotherapy and cancer. I remember interviewing people 20 years ago, and it was almost a bit of a joke. People were like, no, you can't do that. The immune system is compromised when you have cancer. What are you talking about? And now it's a frontline treatment.
Outwardly, it seems like Australia celebrates science and research and scientists. You just have to look at the list of Australians of the year to see there's a lot of prominent scientists in amongst there. But the reality is so very different. You've interviewed a lot of scientists over the past three decades. How have you perceived their feelings about research funding change over that time?
Yeah, so if I think back 10, 20 years ago, they would never talk about funding. They're really just there to tell everyone about their work. Now, almost every single person comes in. brings up the issue of how bad the funding situation is. It is palpable. It is everywhere. There is a change in their attitudes. Many of them seem a bit beaten. And so you've got people who've trained their entire life for this and then being told, well, you know what? The grant you need to continue to work after Christmas has a 10% success rate. Have a nice day. One of the things a lot of people aren't aware of is just recently a report came out called the CERD Report. And this was entitled Ambitious Australia. And it's a redesign, if you will, a recommendations for a redesign of the R&D system in Australia. Very prominent people put this report together. What very few people will realise is that back in 2008, there was a very similar report also delivered to government. That one was called Venturous Australia. So we've gone from Venturous Australia to now we have Ambitious Australia, 16 years apart. And the number one recommendation in both of these reports was to establish a National Innovation Council. So we told government to do this 16 years ago in 2008, and now we've just told them to do it again. And we're wondering what will be different. Do we fast forward 16 years and have a new one called Desperate Australia? Or are we going to listen this time and realise that we are not cutting it?
Dr. Shane Huntington, something medical researchers have wanted is for more money to be dispersed from a big pot of cash called the Medical Research Future Fund. Here's Professor Gina Ravenscroft from the Harry Perkins Institute in Perth, describing how she felt when the fund was announced just over a decade ago.
Oh, it was pretty incredible hearing that we were going to have this completely, entirely new scheme, an entirely new pot of money for medical research. And I think it's probably equivalent to the spending from the NHMRC. So it represented perhaps a doubling of the investment in health and medical research at the time.
So when the Medical Research Future Fund was established, it accrued interest and the government promised to allocate $1 billion a year of research funding once that pot of money hit $20 billion, which it did in 2020. But there's been a spending gap placed on it. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so a few years ago now, I think 2021, the government put a cap in place on the MRFF at around $650 million. So there's a massive gap in what it should be dispersing of this taxpayer funding versus what it's actually dispersing. And it's really unclear to us why that money isn't being fully dispersed. And noting that fully dispersing the fund at the $1 billion would still completely protect that principal investment.
What reasons did the Morrison government give for implementing that cap of $650 million a year?
Yeah, my understanding was that it was implemented to sort of ensure the security of that scheme, that sort of market pressures, if investment collapsed, that fund would be protected. But it's now actually grown to $24 billion. So because of that underspend and how well the investment has performed, there's now even more money there than was originally intended for the scheme. And so estimates from the Parliamentary Budget Office suggests that you could actually double the disbursement up to $1.4 billion without risking the principal component of that investment.
Really? Okay. And have there been any moves to increase that cap or at least bring it back up to the original billion?
Not that I'm aware of. Mm. There's obviously the sector would really love for that to happen, and many of the sort of patient advocacy groups would also love to see that happen.
So the fund is paying out less than what it was originally intended to, so two-thirds of what it was intended to, with no indication in the near future that that will be increased to the original billion it was supposed to be, or even up to the 1.4, which it could be. But that's not the only issue with the Medical Research Future Fund. What are some of the other problems with it?
I guess some of the other challenges might be specifically around sort of the funding success rates or the rejection rates for some of the schemes. So the real challenges for our junior scientists, our early and mid-career researchers, the success rate for those particular schemes targeted specifically at postdoctoral researchers is 4 or 5%,
wow,
which is incredibly low. And that, you know, as I said, speaks to the huge waste in the system, but also the lack of that pipeline. If we don't have the next generation of researchers coming through, who are going to be our research leaders in the future?
Yeah, the path to research success is littered with the careers of postdocs and lab heads and people who have not been able to get funding. It just seems wild to me that we have $24 billion sitting in the bank, accruing all this interest, and yet people are leaving research in droves. Something like more than half of researchers left active research between 2019 and 2024.
Every time funding outcomes get released, up to 90% of applicants don't get funded. And I and others then get emails and phone calls and people crying in our office about what that means for their careers, for their groups, for the research that they're doing. Mm. We're often working on large timescales with these projects, and you can put so much time and energy and effort into answering particular questions that you're working on, and then to suddenly have that end and that lack of job security and certainty around what the future might look like, not only for yourself as a researcher, but for your team and for the students you're training. What do I tell the PhD students in my laboratory about what their future might look like? It's getting harder and harder for me. Even as much as I love and am so passionate about our field and the importance of our sector, it's really hard for me to still say hand on heart to those junior researchers and students that this is a viable career option for them.
Professor Gina Ravenscroft. Federal Science Minister Tim Ayres came into the studio for a chat about the future of Australian research, and he heard her statement.
What's your reaction to that?
I have heard very similar stories in Australian science, but also more broadly across the social sciences as well, where applications in competitive funding rounds inevitably lead to some projects being approved and some projects not being approved. Those merit-based assessments, which aren't done by government ministers, but of course happen in a system that is designed to make sure that scientific merit is dealt with, that doesn't obviate how difficult these processes are for research leaders and their staff who throw everything into an application for funding for the next round. And of course, they're not just doing that in terms of their ARC or CRC funding program or competing within their university for doing it. They're engaging with potential private sector partners and trying to find sources of funding. I recognise this is very tough for Australian researchers. A competitive system brings some advantages, but it does mean, particularly where there are successful programs that don't then get funded for the next round. I absolutely recognise that is a very challenging process for scientists, and it's been a constant feature of Australian science, you know, ever since the system was devised.
Well, 20 years ago, the success rates were more like a quarter to a third. Now it's single digits. And as a result, a lot of the successful grant applications are from big established labs that show they can do the work. They've got the publications behind them. They've got the clout. And so what we see is loads of young people leaving medical research or just research in general. The Australian Health and Medical Research Workforce Audit found that more than 60% of researchers left active research between 2019 and 2024. So in terms of that, what concrete steps are being taken to stop the flow of people, mostly young people, leaving research or just taking their stuff overseas and going to where the money is, like Europe?
Well, there's certainly workforce challenges there now, but also for the future, whether it's in our defence-related programs, medical research, we have to build the workforce of the future. The meeting that I held just a few days ago with 60 of our research institutions and leading private sector players in this area, I made sure that these workforce issues were front and centre. I'm not on your program offering a policy panacea for these questions. I recognise that there are some real challenges there, and everybody in the system who's engaged with young workers in particular are talking about these questions, and I'm very interested in working through how we make Australian science the place that young people in Australia and from around the world want to come and work in.
You said there wasn't going to be a policy panacea presented to us on the Science Show today, but what would be the obvious things that you could do, not just over the next years, but I'm talking maybe the next 12 months?
I don't think it's the kind of set of challenges that invite a short-term answer.
Something rolling. You heard Professor Ravenscroft there. The despair in her voice, it's palpable.
What I'd say is you wouldn't want to be anywhere else. If you've got the capacity and aptitude for science and engineering and maths, you wouldn't want to be anywhere else but the Australian university system or the Australian research institutions. There are challenges there, but it's a very good place to work and it's got a very strong future. Where we can, as a government, open up new opportunities, of course we're doing that. I point to the Horizon Europe opportunity. If you're in medical research or climate and agriculture research, food security research, or defence and related technologies, or energy and electrical systems. The list goes on. Astronomy and space. That opportunity to collaborate and to seek research funding and joint programs with European institutions is an enormous opportunity. It doesn't solve the problem by itself. And as I was suggesting to you, there are workforce issues that, of course, spring from the churn and turn that comes from competitive grants processes. But there are other challenges there too, in workforce terms. And I want to work with the institutions, with the trade unions in this area, with the system more broadly, to look at how we meet that workforce challenge.
You said before that the government has responsibility to fund science and research in Australia, and said earlier this month that it would prioritise investments in science and research that would generate tangible commercial outcomes. But the thing is, we can't predict these things. A lot of the technology that we use came from blue sky or fundamental research. So how do you plan to support that fundamental research?
That effort to work with the science sector, with the CSIRO, with our universities, to direct research and effort into those lines of inquiry that support our national science priorities and our Future Made in Australia objectives. Of course, that is really important work. But it's not to say that there's also not a central role for foundational research. Maintaining that capability in our university systems and in our science agencies is important. There will always be research that sits outside both of those lines of effort as well. And that's important because you just don't know where that leads, what technological solutions that will offer. So I'm, of course, emphasising the research priorities. I want to see alignment and delivery in those areas. But foundational research is of equal importance. And I think it's silly to position them as a binary. We actually need both of these lines of inquiry, which of course intersect and overlap, to be working together.
If one of your kids came to you and said, I want to be a research scientist, what would you say?
Well, I'd say your grandfather was, and he had an incredible career in Australian agriculture. And it is a rewarding career that has a broad social impact. There's not many careers where you get to do work that changes the world. And science is a way of doing that. If one of my kids came along and said that, I'd be absolutely delighted. If they're listening, you can do whatever you want, kids. But of course, the message that we send to young people about work in science careers or engineering careers or trades careers, there's been a bit of a self-fulfilling negative talk in Australia about these questions. Don't say that to obviate the tough challenges and making sure that these are good jobs with good career paths. But we shouldn't talk Australian science down. We shouldn't talk Australian industry down, and we shouldn't talk Australian engineering down. We've got unique capabilities here and a developed economy with a strong system, and we ought to be talking it up and offering as many opportunities as we can.
Oh, for sure. I mean, a line that gets trotted out often is Australian scientists and researchers and engineers punch above their weight.
Yeah.
But they've done so much with so little, and there's only so long that a system under strain can operate before it collapses. What's your outlook for the future?
Well, I'm optimistic about Australian science, and I can see just so clearly the connection between our science effort and the work of all of the researchers and all of the scientists in the system and the big national challenges that Australia needs to solve, to make us stronger, to make us more secure, to deal with the climate and energy and food security challenges for Australia and also for our region. You know, we live in one of the most exciting parts of the world, fastest growing regions of the world in human history. And Australian science has got its role to play here and in our region, making this a really good place to live.
If you were told every 5 years you had to apply for your job and you had a 9% success rate of holding onto your job, would you be in that position? Would you take that job?
Well, as a politician, of course, in the Australian Parliament, we do have to apply for our jobs every 3 years. But it's not the same. And competitive rounds of funding for programs are very challenging. It is a great thing to have a secure job at an Australian university or an Australian science agency. They are really good places to work. But when your job's contingent upon rotating rounds of funding, that is tougher. I absolutely recognise that.
I also asked the Minister about an issue that we've been following on The Science Show for a couple of weeks. The government's recent decision not to pursue full membership of the European Southern Observatory. This would have given Australian astronomers access to top-of-the-line optical telescopes in Chile, including the extremely large telescope, which is on track to start observing the universe in 2030.
Well, of course, I understand that'll be a source of real disappointment for scientists and research and development workers more broadly who would be looking for access to that facility beyond the end of 2027 when our current partnership runs out. And we'll keep working with them. I've, of course, met with representatives of that community and we're looking, of course, at future opportunities, but we declined that round.
What sort of future opportunities are we talking here, specifically for optical telescopes?
Well, we have some domestic capability.
And I guess that would be the Anglo-Australian Telescope at Coonabarabran. Will you commit to ongoing funding of that facility?
It's one of the things that I will be working through with the optical astronomy community, but also our science institutions and public science agencies. We have a range of scientific facilities around Australia that are coming to the point where they will require future investment. We won't be making decisions or public announcements about where we're getting to until we've reached a conclusion, but that facility is very high on my list.
So, Robin, you've seen, I counted, 28 science ministers during the 50-ish years of The Science Show. Given this relatively high turnover of science ministers, is this one reason why we don't really see much progress in terms of things like increasing success rates for research funding?
To some extent, yes, because Barry Jones, who was a science minister under Whitlam, always said that you become a science minister either on the way up or the way down, except in his instance that was there for a long time. And he always said that he was being treated as a science minister in exile when he was no longer. And it's always added on to something else, industry, education, and so on. And quite often when the ministers are being interviewed in public, they are put on tomorrow's questions to do with the household bills in the supermarket, price of petrol, not what is going to be realised in 5 years' time when the point of science, that particular research project, has been realised. Even 5 years' time is being optimistic. You see, apart from training in athletics, science is the most future-based activity we have.
Mm.
You don't just make a breakthrough next month, but then you have examples which are world-shattering. You really need to ask the minister, any minister, why is science so important in Australia? And the answer is there's so much to do and they've created a culture which is magnificent. For example, the one I love is to do with Martin Green, who's held the world record for solar for 32 years. And all the roofs around the world, huge amount, are made based on his research. There are amazing ways you can realise things for the public interest, but you actually have to plan for it.
And you're listening to The Science Show on ABC Radio National.
Speaking of the future of science in Australia, we've heard from Chloe Kwan over the last couple of weeks. Her hatred of science was transformed into what we hope will be a lifelong love. Here she is reading the final part of her article for the Teachers Guild magazine, in which she looks to the future of science education.
I don't wish to end on a negative note. In the next 10 years, we can make a larger improvement than we've seen in the past 20. Almost all of these issues within science education can be resolved, and there is so much hope. Strategies and emphasis on science can shine a light for students around the state, the country, even the world. The most beautiful thing about these issues is that we can overcome it with the proper tools, understanding, and voices. And with these, we can bring science to children and bring up a generation writing, "I love science, it's so fun," in the bright pink Hello Kitty diaries. More resources and funding can be allocated for science teachers, especially in primary schools. Schools have started incorporating more into their science classes, and in not so far away future, maybe primary schools can have their own labs with proper safety precautions. How awesome would that be? A bunch of 6 to 12-year-olds being able to use an actual science lab and see themselves in a white coat and safety goggles. They'd gain hands-on experience with scientific procedure and would have access to real equipment. Addressing issues within science funding for primary school would allow children to gain not only scientific knowledge, but skills that can be used across the board, asking questions, searching for answers, and using evidence to drive conclusions. Even a wet room in classrooms is better than nothing. As more primary school classrooms began to have taps and areas to get messy during my time there, I was able to see a clear difference from my time in kindergarten compared to year four. As we moved to more modern classrooms with special wet areas covered in lino floors, spillages were easier to clean up, and teachers were more likely to allow us to independently experiment, even if it was just with jars, oil, and water. Why? Because there isn't an issue with cleanup or fear of damaging the classroom. I was able to see it myself, to do it myself. I wasn't the one watching the teacher do it. I was the one actually doing it. That was our lab. But imagine what it would be like for children to actually have a whole room to get messy and truly engage. These resources would make our teachers, students, and parents all happier. Children would be able to see what affects their experiments, what works and what doesn't, and how to recognize patterns. Teachers would not have to spend money from their own pockets for resources, and experiments can be repeated until it's understood and until the data stands. Even Professor Buckingham from the Royal Society of Chemistry states, "We need to ensure that all pupils are exposed to the excitement and increased understanding of science that carrying out practical work can bring." This could help bridge the gap between science and students, allowing for more children to actually enjoy it and participate, even if they don't choose to pursue it as a career. These resources also include opportunities, competitions, and initiatives that can interest and involve children in science. Whilst there are many already, schools aren't as involved with these as with English and maths, and they often remain unadvertised. As I went through primary school, we were promoted to participate in school-wide speech competitions, even from kindergarten. And through stage two, we were introduced to advanced math classes and Maths Olympiad. In research done by James Dehan, there is a clear lack of childhood initiatives for science. Indeed, a STEM education report provided to the Australian Education Ministers in 2021 included only one childhood initiative out of 69, equating to just 1.5%. Even looking through a simple Google search, most science competitions and initiatives are aimed towards high school students who are already interested in science. By beginning the exposure of these initiatives earlier and having more opportunities for primary school students, we can foster an interest in science which can carry through high school and beyond outside of the classroom. Through these programs and initiatives, we can give children an avenue to explore further, develop more skills, and see what science has to offer. By challenging their practical and investigative skills, we can improve the fundamental parts of becoming not only a scientist, but a more critical thinker and learner. Without these initiatives, we promote the notion that science is insignificant and unimportant. If we don't see something outside of a classroom, we don't need it in our lives. Science should not and cannot become background noise. Increasing these opportunities and initiatives and more marketing towards them could make a world of difference in how students perceive science and allow them to understand how it applies to the fabric of the world around them. They'll be able to see themselves there.
Chloe Kwan from St George Girls High School reading her article in the Teachers Guild magazine, now complete. And a final reflection on Chloe's ideas from former school principal Petro Papazoglou.
In education, we have such a wonderful blessing with the impact we have on young people, and we have a wonderful opportunity to be able to bring our passions into the classroom. And as a solution for this stagnancy in teaching and education, something that I've seen many successful teachers do is bring their interests from outside the classroom in, whether it be in gardening, whether it be in technology. And myself personally speaking, I'm an avid cyclist, and any opportunity I get, I bring aspects of that world into the classroom.
Here's my bike, look.
Yeah, here's my bike, look. Can you change the gears? Can you clean the bike for me? No, it's not like that. It's, can you change the tyre? How do we change the tyre? kind of forces do we need to be able to lift that tire off the rim? How do we inflate the tire? How does pressure work? And then in terms of that repeatability, we had one experience where brought in a tire for an adult on a rim and brought in a children's tire on a rim as well. And we discussed which is easier, which is harder to change. What do we notice in differences in tread pattern as well? Why would a child's tire need more tread than an adult? You know, there's so many avenues of thought.
Now, why would they?
Do you think children finding it easier to ride in a straight line, or do you think they're wobbling left and right, Robin? So I think they'll need a bit more grip for those learning situations. It's a chance. You know, I've seen wonderful avenues of learning where teachers have come back from overseas. Those wonderful holidays, 12 weeks off a year, I'm certain teachers are not sitting with their hands on their lap for 12 weeks waiting for school to start again. Teachers are wonderful role models who experience so many things in those holidays. You know, it might be travel, might be visiting family and friends, it might be investigating something of their own interests. If they could bring those ideas into the classroom, it would make for such an enriching learning experience for the children.
And be themselves as well.
Exactly, be themselves. Because when you travel, for example, and you bring back some artifacts from overseas, I saw a teacher bring back, in an early childhood environment, bring back some artifacts from Japan and show the children. When questions were asked, the teacher was so excited to share their insights. They weren't avoiding questions. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, when a child asked another question and they wanted to go back, the teacher was more than happy to go back and look at that with them because it was something they were passionate and excited about teaching and learning about.
Petro Papazoglou, now head of education, early childhood education actually, at Rise and Shine, and bringing his bike in for early education in perhaps engineering, as long as he brings it in several times.
I remember when I was in high school, my physics teacher was also my rowing teacher, and so he used to combine the two in classes. It was really cool. Now, before we go, we were saddened by the news that zoologist and author Desmond Morris passed away in April, aged 98. He was best known for his book, The Naked Ape, a zoological and behavioural study of humans, published in 1967. Here he is in an interview from 2000, talking about how he came to write The Naked Ape.
As a child growing up during World War II, it occurred to me that human beings were a very odd species because, as far as I could tell, when you grew up, what you had to do was to blow one another to pieces. So I became more and more obsessed with watching animals. And to cut a long story short, I spent the next 20 years of my life as a zoologist studying animal behavior. But then, having gone from fish and birds and insects to mammals and eventually to chimpanzees, I decided that I ought to have a look at this rather strange species, human being, and I thought, shall I try something which is a little bit outrageous, but I'm going to try and look at people in exactly the same way that I've looked at other animals. In fact, my thesis when I was at Oxford had chapter headings which were just exactly the same as the chapter headings in The Naked Ape, except that my thesis was on the stickleback. And now I was studying the human species, but I had the same chapter headings. And I treated human beings exactly as I treated sticklebacks and looked at their reproductive behavior, at their feeding behavior, at their fighting behavior, and so on. I thought this was an objective way of studying human beings. I was, in my mind, elevating us to the level of my beloved animals. But other people took a rather dim view of what I was doing and thought I was denigrating human beings by reducing them to the level of animals. And so I was astonished at the reaction to this book. I couldn't believe the anger it caused. I'd called us naked apes not to insult us, but simply because if I was looking at this species for the first time and I said, what on earth is it? Then obviously it's rather like an ape, but it's got no fur on its body. So I called it the naked ape. It was a logical step to take.
Robin, did you know Desmond Morris?
I knew him quite well, yes. We lived close to each other also in Oxford. But he was sensational in many ways for many years, especially in Britain and around Europe and indeed America. But controversial because he often, when writing about the naked ape, looked at our bodies and saw all sorts of affiliations with not just apes but various other creatures, perhaps too closely, some people thought. Next week, we celebrate 100 years of a natural history broadcasting legend.
Robin, I didn't know you were that old.
No, that other one, David Attenborough.
All right.
The Science Show is produced by David Fisher. I'm Robin Williams, and I'm 104.
And I'm Belinda Smith, not 104.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.